Hey everybody, I think we are ready to get started. We have a good group of people in the audience. We have a great panel. Welcome to the first installment of the Multilingual Fall series. My name is Jonas Ryberg. I'm with Pactera Edge. I'll be moderating this today. This started as a white paper from Pactera Edge and NIMSE Insights on global customer experience. We found the topic intriguing, so we thought that it would make sense to share some of the findings from the white paper, as well as get input from a panel of experts in the industry on this topic of lovable global customer experience. So before I introduce the panel, I wanted to share a few data points from the white paper. And by the way, we'll make this white paper available to everyone attending today as well, I believe. So keep your eyes peeled for that. But to the data, in the white paper, we found that companies that localize user experience see an increase of 100 to 400% in sales in local markets. So knowing which markets are more sensitive to localized user experiences can inform how to allocate localization budget for maximum ROI. We also found that users buy in English all the time out of necessity, but online storefronts in their own language can seal the deal for the 70% of customers who report that they're hesitant to spend without the localized experience. And finally, we found that localization drives user conversions. So 9 out of 10 report that they would be more likely to purchase a product or service localized for their market. So obviously all this data really shows the importance of having a lovable global customer experience where localization is one part, but there's much more to it. So we want to try to uncover some of the aspects of that, some of the data points, some of the strategies that you can use to create that lovable customer experience. But let me introduce the panel. So I'll start from the top alphabetically. First, I want to introduce Adriana Grande. Adriana is a user experience designer and localization specialist at Roku. She combines her skill sets to create unique experiences for the international user, in addition to expanding brand awareness in the global market. Next, we have Mimi Hills. Mimi brings her skills and experience as a leader in the high-tech sector. As both advisory member of Codecheck and former director of product localization at VMware, where she oversaw the localization operations for product, services, and documentation. Mimi just retired from VMware this week. Congratulations, Mimi. And then we have Pedro, Pedro Gomez. Pedro is the principal program manager lead at Microsoft Search Ads and Youth. Where he drives a feature roadmap that grows users, engagement, and revenue across the globe. Pedro is also the chairperson of the Globalization and Localization Association. And then finally, we have Pushpinder. Pushpinder Lobana heads up customer research for global content at PayPal. She focuses on creating impactful customer experiences by understanding cultural nuances in language attitudes and meaning. So, great panel for this topic. Welcome everyone. I appreciate you taking the time to share your insights in this area. So we want to start by defining customer experience to make sure that we're all on the same page. When we met before this webinar, we found that there are certain aspects of this that is important to highlight. If I start with you, Pushpinder, how do you define customer experience in your scope?
Absolutely. That's a great question. You know, for us, customer experience means creating very cohesive end-to-end experiences for our customers as they interact with the brand, the product, the features, and the services. And when we say end-to-end, we literally mean at any given point as they interact with your products and features, you're creating that lovable experience, that experience that resonates for them. And this could be your marketing pages, it could be your product, live product experience, it could be the support that they get when things go wrong. And it also includes all the communications we send them, right? Text messages, emails, et cetera. And so what we do at PayPal is that we ground our customer experience in starting with the customer. We learn about the customer. We focus on what is it that they need, what makes sense, what's culturally and locally relevant, what are their behaviors and attitudes, what's the meaning behind the language that they use. So that all those insights actually inform the practice of UX design, content design, and our localization at PayPal. And just to give you a sense of the you know, drilling down a little bit on that. So in my role in the global content and technology team, this means that we deliver those experiences in the right language, in the right market, with the right tone of voice, using the right terminology, and also using culturally relatable and relevant icons, illustrations, photography, because it does go beyond language. So that's how we approach and how we perceive customer experience at PayPal.
Got it, thank you. Mimi, would you add something to this? Is it different to you, or do you look at it the same way?
I think that Pushpinder just gave a great description of the whole thing. In my world, what we've mostly focused on is the product. We're looking at the product interface and the documentation and how that plays into it. I think one of the things I'd like to point out is the trend toward inclusive language right now as a way, not just, so we're looking at that. I mean, the industry is looking at that in English for the first time, I think, opening up their eyes to it, which is a wonderful trend. And we're extending that into the localization of it as well. So just another aspect where I think people are thinking more broadly about that customer experience, what it means, how do you not offend people while you are trying to make that experience more lovable?
Okay. And if we narrow it down a little bit to what positive customer experience is, and I'll ask Pedro in this case, can you share any benefits that you've observed in your role on positive customer experience?
Sure. At the end of the day, you know, a positive customer experience is one that helps the users achieve what they are trying to do with as little friction and as little entanglements as possible. When that happens, you know, the users are going to be using your product more often, which results in better business metrics for you and your organization. If you look at my product is a content and search experience. So what we actually do is we look at the consumption and the engagement with the product, and we are tracking this throughout all of the different features. And this, typically we have a very strong correlation between the content that we present to the users in the different markets and the usability of the site or the applications. So the more that content is customized to the context of the user and presented in their own language, the more that we see adoption of the product. At the end of the day, you know, you always have to begin with the end in mind, you know, what is it that you're trying to achieve, and put yourself in the shoes of the users, build users for the users, and then that translates into direct KPI improvement for your organization.
Got it. So Pushpinder mentioned a fairly wide scope end-to-end, and we talked about a lot of different aspects here, both what it is and the positive aspects of it. Adriana, when we talked previously before this webinar, you mentioned that you would like to really highlight the fact that customer experience is one thing and user experience is something else or part of that. Can you talk a bit about how you see customer experience and user experience relating to each other?
Sure. In fact, user experience is an older term than customer experience. If you look at the Lucy Norman Group, they define user experience as what encompasses all the aspects of a person interaction with the company, services, and products. If you think about it, the term user experience came about when they were incorporating human computer interaction into the field. So it was more about the contact direct of a person and a computer. And that expanded, and it was kind of renamed, the whole experience was renamed as customer experience. So we now see many that say customer experience is what Pushpinder beautifully defined is from the beginning introduction of that product or company or brand to the user until the final interaction with the product. And now many call UX, user experience, that final interaction between the user and the product. But all in all, it encompasses the good experience that someone may have with a product, a brand, and a product, and a company. So those things go together. They used to be one. And the truth is, they're still kind of part of the same umbrella, and they should all work together.
Okay, great. And another aspect of that, we're doing this obviously in the multilingual fall series, is localization. And I talked a bit about localization when we mentioned the data points ahead. So if I go back to you again, Pushpinder, can you talk a bit about how customer research in your world impacts content and localization mm-hmm. decisions?
Yes.
So,
in my role, I'm responsible for gathering insights in the 28 languages that PayPal is offered in globally. And, you know, customer research is a very integral part of the global content and technology team at PayPal. And we've built actually a practice now of research, social science research, with data science. And what we aim to do is to take insights. When we blend those two views, we take insights and we channel them back to our linguists and our localization team, as well as our content design team, who's actually building the source experience, the source content. And what we're driving in our team is a data-driven approach. And I like to say data, but I actually want to say insights, because sometimes data by itself may not give you insights. It's the combination, you know, of different sources. It may be qualitative data as well. So, you know, we're really driving our team, our content and localization team, to adopt an insight-driven approach to making decisions about which terminology to use, what words will work in which market, how do you approach the value prop messaging that the brand has laid out. And I'll give you a couple of examples just to give you a sense of the impact that this approach has had on our teams. So for instance, in Japan recently, we conducted a research study with our Japanese customers who use PayPal to understand what did they think about the PayPal tone of voice in the Japanese experience. And you know, we had heard some feedback from our Japanese business partners that said that our tone of voice in Japanese was very formal. And so rather than going with one person's opinion, we were like, let's do some research. Let's talk to customers who are actually the ones experiencing this. And our research showed that, and this was quantitative and qualitative, and basically our research showed that Japanese customers think they prefer an informal, polite tone in the PayPal experience. And they want that infused with empathy and confidence and enthusiasm, which are the three aspects of the PayPal tone of voice. So they want that informal, polite tone infused with the right emotion at the right time. And what that research has done now is that it has, you know, it's going to make us rethink our style guide. It's going to make us think about our Japanese localization approach. Right. So, you know, these are the kind of insights that we take from the market, and we funnel that back into our content creation process and our localization process. And then one additional example, because I'm nerding out on research here, bear with me. But one additional example is on grammatical gender. To Mimi's point in the beginning of the panel, she spoke about inclusive language. Right. And we are all about that. And so for us, it's like, are we perpetuating bias through the language we use? 38% of the world's population speaks a gendered language where the noun is either masculine, feminine, animate, inanimate, or other, right? And so we've had to take a hard look at our approach to localizing a gendered language. And a couple of languages that we're doing research on are Polish and German. And we're approaching this from the perspective, like, you know, are we doing the best we can in terms of our approach to how we localize a gendered language? Are we inclusive enough in the way we localize? So those are some examples of how our research practice has actually transformed how we approach localization.
So Adriana, if I turn to you again, so you're both a UX designer and a localization expert. Have you seen any other examples or ways of working with the localization team as a UX expert or team?
Yes, and I have seen some that have not been my work, but something that I had investigated and also informally researched. But the bottom line is that you want to create that experience that talks to the user as if this was created for them, for their own language and for their own culture. And both Mimi and Pushpinder brought this up. It's very important to have inclusive language. And there's a lot of that that still doesn't happen. I am Brazilian, so I speak Portuguese. And my language is one where we use gender for people and objects and everything kind of varies according to number and gender. So it's gonna be hard for us to get to that point, but it's something that is of value and needs to be done. One of the things that I wanted to bring about when talking to, kind of following up what Pushpinder said, is that there's tremendous value when you localize that experience. Because it's not just the translation. A lot of people think that localization is the translation. One of the things that I observe is that currently, or at least in many companies I've seen, is that the current process has UX and localization in the opposite end of the product creation process. And these should be close together. Because when you are creating them together, or you give room for localization to be close to UX and vice versa, then you have a chance to catch design flaws or things you may have not thought. You can conduct user testing, even informally, in those multi-languages and find out the kind of insights Pushpinder just mentioned. You get feedback from your developers and your linguists and other people involved in the company. You get ready to launch your product in multiple languages because you kind of weeded out a whole lot of problems that can come if you leave localization to the end. And not only that, you lower the risk of having lower errors in localization and redesign. And I have seen that in many projects that I have worked. So to have that positive impact, you need to think about what is the cost of not doing this the right way, right? What if happens when you push those too far apart and then wait to see what happens? So what is the cost? And then analyze this and then maybe decide, well, it's time to put those two together and then save from a lot of costs and problems that will absolutely happen.
If I can jump in there, I think you bring up a great point, Adriana, and without sharing specifics, recently we conducted research where, you know, to your point about how do we bring it together, right? How do we take the UX and the product world and bring it together, because they actually, you know, inform each other, right? And mm-hmm. you can catch problems upstream instead of downstream, where it gets very painful. You know, so we did a research project because we realized that, you know, in the way our onboarding process is set up for our merchants globally, there were some pain points and frustration. And it was all related to content in terms of the terminology. So how we call certain roles in certain businesses, right? The owner, the shareholder, you know, the CEO, those kind of terms that we led with that were simply localized to those markets weren't working. And so we had to go back and sort of bring the product team into it and say, let's do some research, let's look at these markets and understand from a terminology perspective, do these terms even make sense? Not only from the perspective of how businesses are structured in these countries, but how do people perceive the role behind this term, right? What are the functions of the shareholder, the owner? And it was amazing because we were able to simplify the source experience, the product experience based on these insights and actually drive business impact because we ended up simplifying to a set of terms that made the most sense to these customers. And that led to a much better onboarding experience and less friction, which in turn led, you know, to that business number that you really want to see at the end of the day, right? Like that's how you show, you know, proof in the pudding, right? The business impact. So just to your point, you know, we need to integrate the product world with the UX world so that we can actually work towards that same goal.
Point. I want to pick up on something else that you mentioned, Pushpinder, earlier, talking about you focused on Japanese or the Japan market in one aspect of your research. So I want to, given the fact that the data that we got from this white paper about increasing sales 100 to 400% and so on by doing that, I want to ask the rest of the panel as well, if you measure customer experience for each market, and if so, what data would you track for those parts?
Yeah, so I can take this question, Jonas. So if you look at my product, Microsoft News, it's a very widely used product, and we look at that. What is the business impact? You know, we typically have over 550 million users every month who come to the product from 180 markets, and we make the product available in 31 languages. The other data point that we tracked is our position versus other multi-platform news sites in the world. According to Comscore, we are number one. So we do have a lot of metrics about, you know, the business impact of the product. Now, what we do is that, and the advantage of this type of online product is that in the past, traditionally, you build product in a box, you put them in a store, and then you got some feedback from users maybe a couple of years later. Now, with an online digital business, you instrument the site and the experience so that you can see what users are reacting to or what they are not enjoying real time. And this gives you a tremendous amount of information that you can use to refine your product. Now, clearly, data and privacy is a very sensitive topic. So, you know, in our case, before collecting any data, we either do it through transparent voluntary feedback mechanisms where the users have got an option to come to us and say, hey, you know, we have a problem with this particular area of the product or with this language or market. And that is something that we look at in every market and we react to as needed. And then alternatively, we also look at fully anonymized usage data. So what we do is that through telemetry, we can see what content and what features are resonating with users that we can then accumulate or slice and dice at different levels. You know, do we buy entry point, buy market, buy language? And this allows us to begin to see macro trends that we can incorporate to inform some of the future product decisions. Now, one thing that we do all the time as part of being an online product is that we're always running experiments. At any given point in time in our digital products, we're running tens of different experiments where we typically create a default experience and then some treatments that we measure against our default. And what we find is that, you know, we're all very, very smart, very hardworking people, and we come up with a bet that we believe will make the product better. But typically what we find is that the majority of our experiments yield a result that we had not anticipated, which is always a great data point. And you want to do this in as quick a way as possible so that you fail fast, learn from your explorations, and then incorporate them to make the product better in the future. Now, to do this, we have, as I said, a fairly sophisticated instrumentation system that runs throughout the site. And then we create scorecards that let us look at what people's enjoy or don't enjoy about the product. And we typically look at the actions that people take on the site. Do they click on the content? Do they scroll on the page? Do they interact with our menus? Or dwell time, how long they stay in our product. And we also, that gives us quantitative information about the product. And then we also look at qualitative information, like what is the feedback that people give us verbatim from the markets. And when we look at all of this, we actually take culture and market situations into account. You know, if you look at user feedback, some markets typically give you very positive feedback no matter what you do. Other markets tend to be more critical. So you have to be mindful of what is the cultural makeup of the different countries. At the same time, you know, you always have to look at what is going on at the market at the same time that may give you a false signal in your experiments. For instance, we had China on holidays for the best part of 1 week last week. If you were running an experiment or if you were looking at your user engagement metrics in China last week, you would have seen a tremendous drop. And if you just by looking at the numbers alone, you wouldn't be able to explain it. So having that understanding of the cultural and geoeconomic background of the markets is a great supplement to understand how users are engaging with the product. Other thoughts?
So, go ahead, Mimi. Sorry about that.
I was just going to say that I think that's really interesting. At VMware, we experience an extra level of complexity in that so many of our products are handled through partners and resellers. And so the instrumentation that if we deploy a product, we might have about the end users, we don't necessarily have it. And so working with our partners, interviewing them, asking them for data, which they guard very closely, not just for competitive reasons, as well as for legal reasons, really, really super important. So I think Pushpinder, at one point you mentioned it's qualitative data as well as the quantitative data. We really have to look at everything. And we do use this to inform localization as well, because we all have limited budgets. I wish we didn't. I wish we could always do the right thing in every language. But there are places where we know that localization might be, that higher quality might be more important. And so getting it right is more important. In other places, time to market might be more important, and getting it done quickly is very much more important. And so all that data has to be balanced and brought into the picture in terms of how we localize those customer experiences.
I think those are all the kind of things that we as well, track, all the stuff, Pedro, you mentioned, A/B testing, qual and quant. Just to add, though, to the picture, so for us, we understand that every market is different and that the questions or the ways we measure customer experience has to adjust to the market a little bit. That said, we do have there are industry accepted standards, there are single metrics that can be taken as a way to get a signal of where there may be a problem in which language. And to mention a few, the Net Promoter Score or NPS is one that a lot of brands use, but we've moved away from NPS because we think that it's a brand level question versus a content localization quality question. So we've moved towards a customer effort score, which is also an industry accepted standard. It's a CES, it's a 5-point scale. And essentially, it gives us, think of it as a signal. That's all it is, right? Because you want to triangulate data from different sources to really zero in on where the problem lies. And so we see our CES at the high, you know, altitude where, you know, it gives us a sense of which market, which language there may be an issue in terms of the ease of use of completing a certain task, a certain, you know, experiencing a certain feature. And then we complement that with a data view in terms of behavioral analytics. What are customers actually doing on the site, right, in these markets and in this language? So we complement that with behavioral analytics and also customer self-reported ratings, right? So we'll pop up surveys in the experience, you know, where we ask them, you know, how rate the tone of voice, rate the content quality that you just experienced at the end of the task. And so all of those data points help us triangulate information that then becomes very actionable for our teams. And so our data scientists have created data dashboards where we've trained our linguists and our design team, our content team, to go in and explore, you know, check the languages, check the scores, check the ratings. And, you know, we've seen a lot of success with that model.
I would like to add something to it. The more I hear from you guys who have deep experience in this area too, I hear a stronger reason for why should we start this earlier in the process? Because a lot of these things can be found in the ideation and the research stages of the product creation. Of course, none of us are in a business that is starting up. But when we start looking at those things way early in the process, then we have chances to figure that out and tailor our style guide and tailor all the things that we already know about the user expectation of that locale. And then when it comes to the time of tracking this data, we will not be surprised with things that were not working. Because if we did our homework all earlier and we're not working in silos and UX in this corner, thinking about the design and localization in this corner, thinking about this, but we are collaborating and we are working together, then what happens is that when the product is released and we are looking at this data, we'll see better results. We'll see better engagement. We'll see more user satisfaction, right? The consumers are happy. They are buying, they're using the product. And this is all because of that big cycle that has to happen. So I keep going back to the point that the earlier we put those two together, the better we'll see, better result we'll see towards the end. Like how amazing it is to look at your data and see that all things are falling into place. And it's like, what a great satisfaction, right? This is a great sign that the work has been done early. And I think that a great thing is that you build trust with the people, whoever they are, whatever they are, you know, users, independent where they are, if they are happy and they trust your brand and they trust your product, they will be your ambassadors. And then that will just bring more business. So there's no negative in doing those things earlier on and working them together, because that's what we all want. And a lot of those things we'll find out on, instead of finding them later on by data, finding, oh, why this data is not reflecting this way, let me go back and find out. This is also a way to do it. So I guess the $1 million question is that how do we put UX and localization to work together, right? So there's different ways to do this. Ideally, you know, the mythical world of perfection, we would have figured that out day one and we would have the budget, right, Mimi? We would have all these things kind of working together. But the reality is that it doesn't always work that way. Things just happen. So whatever you are, what can you do to make this happen and to work in such a way that later, as you're looking at the data, you have the best data you can get?
Yeah, and I think that's a great point, Adriana. And I think that the way that I like to think about this is it's a bit of a virtuous cycle. You know, we have the opportunity to learn about stuff and do better in the future. And it starts at the beginning, you know, when we have an ideation phase for a product, you have to be thinking about, you know, is this product going to be successful worldwide? Do I need to make any adaptations? Talking with the spec owner, with your program manager, do we need to make any adaptations to the functionality, to the content payload, so that this product is successful worldwide? So you inject yourself into the ideation phase. Then when it comes to execution and code development, typically from a globalization point of view, we provide two types of services depending on the organization. You do the localization of the UI strings and that you want to automate as much as possible. And you may also want to do international software internationalization consulting, because there are some areas of software internationalization, such as the right to left thing, which are the gift that keeps on giving. And frankly, many developers don't work on this stuff every day, so they need to be trained and educated. After that, you go into the deployment phase. You know, your team, and whether you're a vendor or an FDE at any of these organizations, can help make sure that the product is properly accessible from the market in the languages and with the content that you expected in all of the languages. From that point on, you go into more of a maintenance mode, where you collect data about the product, you look at the feedback, both quantitative and qualitative analysis, as we were saying, and that actually spans new ideas that feed the next phase of the ideation. And this allows you to create a cycle where you make the product better and better over time, and you also build that trust, because you become the go-to person for this part of the product with the engineering teams.
Pedro, one of the things that you're saying really resonates with me, and it almost sounds a little bit like what we're saying in diversity and inclusion areas, that we need to be each other's allies. And we're coming from these diverse groups, we're coming together from different areas, and we're in complete agreement with each other that you know, the UX, the customer experience, the localization, we have to be each other's allies. I think I've been fortunate in my most recent role that I also had the technical publications team in my group, and we became each other's allies and could fight for each other and always bring, if only one of us was in a product team meeting, we could easily represent the other team. It's really important. And so it's not about us being there all the time in every meeting, because that's really hard, but learning about each other's fields and representing each other and say, oh, you need to talk to Pedro or Adriana or Pushpinder. It's not just me.
And just to end that note with, you know, my work in customer research would not be successful for a global company like PayPal if I didn't work closely with our linguists and our localization team. I do not speak German or Polish or Japanese. And, you know, I'm coming in from a social science perspective. I'm interested in language, culture, and technology. But at the end of the day, I'm not a linguist. And I have to work very closely on every research project with our linguists to identify the nuances that can, down to the survey question, down to what we ask our customers in these research studies. So
I think what we're doing the best here with this panel is that not only we're advocating, but we are open doors for other people who are listening to this to understand a little bit more and become informed and want to learn more and continue to advocate this, that even though we work in silos in most companies, we still can be each other allies, and we can still bring in the points that Mimi said. We need to know who is who and who knows what. And we need to incorporate these people in the conversation, or at least, if we don't need to be in all meetings, but we need to know where we are and where are each other's strength. So like Pushpinder said, I go and talk to localization. Where I'm localization, I go talk to UX. And as Pedro mentioned, we may not be in the beginning of the product, but there is a cycle. So even if there's just a new feature coming up, how are you going to name that feature in English? Well, what if you bring the somebody from localization to see what is the impact if I call this feature, you know, X name? Would that be something that will work? And then bring somebody from UX, or how does this work in the UI we're presenting this? Do we need to think about space? So there's all these conversations that need to be happening and not divided in silos. They have to be together at some point. So the way I think this could work is that we could have either conversations formally or not, meetings. We could have somebody to represent the department to go talk to these other people, or we should at least be aware, because not everybody, like Pushpinda said, will know all languages or will be a linguist and will work in UX or will work in content writing. We need to be our best allies. In fact, I tend to tell everyone that I know that UX and localization needs to walk hand in hand, because we should be our best friends. We should be working together, because together we make the best product and we make our customers and our users happy.
Great. Total agreement on the panel, I love it. So one aspect here that I think is important, so you're talking about getting sort of upstream and addressing both the global customer experience and localization in general early on, right? Getting part of the ideation and design phase. I think one way to address that would be to highlight the ROI, right, of local adaptations. Have you seen any good data around that or approaches to establishing potential ROI?
Yeah, so if you look at my company, Microsoft, we have a mission to empower every person and every organization on the planet to achieve more. Part of that gives us a global ambition. And, you know, we tend to look at language and culture adaptation as another flavor of accessibility. You know, you typically think about accessibility as making products usable for people with a disability, whether temporary or permanent. But if you don't have access to information in a language that you can understand, then it presents the same type of barrier. So typically for my product, you know, all of the UI elements are translated. That's fairly standard. Now, the interesting thing about my product is that we are a news product. So UI represents a very small part of what we do. We actually had to come up with content which is sourced locally. So if you look at the Microsoft News in the States, in Canada, or in Japan, even if the language is shared, the content comes from a different local source. We have over 1,200 publisher partners worldwide, which equate roughly translating to 4,500 different brands. So if you're looking at you know, any topic, for instance, a soccer match, and I'm a fan, and we have had some European championships this last week, you know, you can see the same match, basically the same event, covered from two different angles. And we had to go through the effort of actually reaching out to the publisher partners in all of those markets. So the UI is translated, the data is sourced locally. And then in some cases, we make some UI adaptations depending on the market. Typically, Japan is the sweet spot because they are a fairly large market and they typically have a different UI UX representation. So if you look at our product in Western cultures, we typically like a very minimalistic approach where you have a lot of white space. In Japan, we had to experiment and validate that a higher content density it drives more engagement, and that's something that we do. Now, you cannot adapt every product to every market in a scalable, efficient, and economical way. So typically we look at the ROI, and ROI for us is typically defined as, you know, do we get multiples of the investment by way of additional engagement from the users, or we may look at some other opportunities where we have the possibility of actually significantly growing the users or aligning with another initiative that the company has as part of the strategy. So we will use those criteria, dollars, users, and alignment to decide how deep we go into the market. And again, if you look at our product, in some markets we have a dedicated native experience. In other markets, we fall back to a culturally suitable substitute because there is no ROI for us to invest in them.
I echo what you say, Pedro. One of the ways that we've been able to show ROI is by example. So there's nothing better than a new product in a new market. And so when we've done an acquisition and say the Japanese team says, if you localize, I can't sell this, but if you localize this, I can sell X million. And we say, okay, well, it's gonna cost you 200,000 to localize. We think that's a pretty reasonable ROI. So we show that kind of ROI and then we track it over time. And then that becomes the example. And while Japanese is a great example, it's just one market, but it's a prime market and people are often willing to start with that. And then when they see the return, they go on to the next language. We'd rather have people do all of our 7 languages all at once, but it's a great way to get people started. And having that example is a prime, a very nice way of showing that it works.
Okay. So being mindful of time, great conversation so far, but let's shift gears a little bit and look at some maybe advice for the audience. So what about pitfalls? What type of challenges have you run into? Do you have any good examples of things that people should be aware of and try to avoid?
I can take that one. You know, we were, just as to an example that we learned about a market more closely and it informed our localization process very much, which is India. So we had a product team that was getting ready to release a feature in India in 12 languages. And they were going to just use the traditional approach, you know, localize it to 12 languages, take the US source experience and translate it to those 12 Indian languages. You know, when you think about India, it has 1.3 billion people and there are 23 official languages. And there's incredible complexity in terms of culture and how people interact with technology and all of that. So we made a case with the product team that we needed to understand this market, even if it's a couple of languages that in the Indian context, to really, you know, shape our approach for this very key market. And we ended up going in with a couple of assumptions, which were proved wrong. The first assumption was that we assumed that people with low literacy in English or limited literacy in English would not be using apps in English. And that if we offered the app in their native language, they would use it. And that assumption, you know, fell apart when we actually did ethnographic research with customers who use apps like Google Pay and Amazon Pay. And we found that people with low or limited literacy in English are actually preferring to use those apps in English because the native language in the digital translation is too complex and was written in a very old-fashioned, complex, you know, not conversational approach. And so people who are even very literate in their own language, in Hindi or Malayalam, chose to use the apps in English. And it was just really an aha moment for us that, you know, what is not being delivered through the localized experience that this is the scenario, right? And so we ended up actually finding some great insights on how people actually, you know, they use a combination of languages, you know, that's how they talk in everyday life. You know, we need to think about localization approaches that mimic those everyday conversations that are more colloquial and things around consistency and, you know, what words we use in the UI and how simple we keep it. And it's really actually helped the product team understand the value of customer insights to inform the localization.
I'm going to bring a new example to going for what Spinder said. I'm working on a side project for a Brazilian TV news channel. And one of the things, like, we sometimes have perceptions of people. The Brazilian people are perceived as a very playful people, very laid back and fun kind of people. However, in certain topics, if you want to evoke that feeling of trustworthiness, you have to have a level of seriousness in your tone. Otherwise, they don't take you seriously, and then you become like a gossip column, right? They will not think that you are you're worth their time. So it's interesting because you have to go into the culture, and it's not only just going into the language, because understanding the culture and understanding who you want to reach and what you want to get from them, it also needs to have that understanding, what are their expectations, right? You have to find out up to what point you need to be serious and formal, and how much can you afford to be casual and friendly. One of the examples that I saw in my last travel to Brazil last year, and everywhere I go, I'm doing kind of case studies as I observe everything around me, because I haven't lived in Brazil for so long, and I want to see what changed. So I take notes of everything, and then I ask questions. One of the things that I noticed is that in the last 30 years, the tone and formality that financial institutions, banks talk to their customers are still the same. So even though you can walk into a bank and playfully talk to somebody, when you go through the UI of a bank, it has a very formal tone still. They talk to you as sir and ma'am, where no one in Brazil will talk to you as sir and ma'am. But that's the expectation. And that means, well, if they are dealing with your money, they are taking you seriously, and that builds trust. So the bottom line is that they want you to see them as they want to be seen. And that takes insight. And that's when it's not only important to know the grammar and the structure of the language as a linguist. That's when you really need that study of the people. The ethnographical studies are super important. User testing are super important, because those are the insights you're only going to get through qualitative data, not quantitative data.
Point.
Go ahead.
I'll just quickly mention a couple of other kinds of pitfalls I think that people have run into from not considering the end-to-end customer experience. So in one case, it was not even about language. It was simply, what point in the cycle do they calculate the tax? And it didn't work for every country. So that was one way to do it. Another time when I worked for BlackBerry, and a matter of the device, BlackBerry was huge in Indonesia, but they ride around on their scooters and they hold their phone in one hand. And if you have an app that needs two hands, people aren't going to use it, because they have to be able to just, you know, hopefully they're at a stop sign and they're quickly entering something in their phone. But there's so much about the end-to-end customer experience that's really important to understand country by country.
Great. So I wanted to stay on the topic of advice. So if you consider someone who's just entering into a decision maker role for globalization or localization, what should be their first couple of actions to address the global customer experience?
I think if I may take this one, if you think about if I think about myself 20 years ago, you know, three things would come to mind. I think that in the industry, we tend to spend a lot of time talking about the activity that we perform and not the impact that we drive. At the end of the day, we do all of these things because we're helping companies reach a global audience. So it is beneficial for us to talk about the opportunity that we can unlock through these activities, rather than the details of the execution. There's typically a lot of discussion about details of execution, and that makes people see you as a cost rather than as a growth driver, which is going to engage a different conversation. And in doing that, you know, one thing that I would say is use the industry resources. So Pactera and Ninzi have got this great piece of research that you can share with your management and say, hey, you know, it's not me just telling you, it's industry experts telling you that you have an opportunity to expand your global opportunity. Then I would also encourage people to think beyond translation. You know, beginning with the end in mind, if you're trying to drive more engagement and user growth globally, what else can you do across the world to make sure that new users learn about your product, find the product, they try it, they buy it, they use it, and then they get support in their local market. And then finally, my pet peeve is to treat English as another language and ENUS as another market. Part of a continuum of markets rather than the first product that then gets translated, adapted, and localized internationally. You know, at the end of the day, you're trying to reach the world, all 7.5 billion of people. English and the United States are two big markets, but they shouldn't be driving the entire conversation. You should be thinking about this holistically and be market and language agnostic when you're designing your experience. That's what I wished I had known 20 years ago.
Those are such excellent. Okay, I'll pause.
Go ahead, Paul.
No, Adriana, you go first.
I was just going to say a good practice to have is to ask a lot of questions. In localization, we may not be trained to ask a lot of questions, right? We receive text, we react to it. But that's when my UX training comes to hand, because before we do anything, we ask questions. And those questions may lead to sometimes another direction, but it always leads you to what you need to know. So before you write anything, start asking questions about that people and that culture and that language, their behavior, their frustrations, their expectations. What do they already know? What they already used to? What they are connecting with? What is successful? What is not? What is missing? So there's so many questions that need to be answered. And those questions are not questions that have to be asked only in the beginning. This is a never-ending process, because using a UX word, iteration, you should be doing this over and over again. In fact, you should, every time you get data, you should ask those questions again and see if that is still the goal. If you're still reaching all the goals you want, or should we have higher goals? What should you do to get to higher goals? What this leads to next? What doors are being opened? So I think questions are something that we should start practicing and get better at asking questions.
Agree 100%. And the other thing that I'll add to that is ask questions about the product, because a lot of us handle many, many different products in our jobs, and each one of them may need something different. So ask questions about the users, about the culture, and ask questions about the product.
You want to add something, Pushpinder?
All, you know, everything that you all have said, I echo, completely. I think the one thought that was coming in my mind is, you know, become an advocate for the customer in your team. Be the voice in the room, that asks those questions as the linguist, as the localization expert. You know, you're working possibly with, you know, a US-based team. I'm making a huge assumption here, but, the product manager for that product is perhaps US-based and may not be thinking about all these nuances. But as the localization expert, as the linguist, you know, take it upon yourself to become the advocate for the customer. Ask those questions upfront and get a seat at the table. You know, ask, when can I see the creative strategic brief on this one? You know, tell me exactly how this product is gonna work. Elbow your way in. I mean, I think this is where, like, we just have to advocate for ourselves and our customers, because no one's going to do it other than you.
Can I just add something to it? Another thing that I just thought is that get to know your product really well. Know the ins and outs of the product as you have. So as new features are coming in, you have a better insight of what they are trying to do, and then you can ask better questions. Other thing too is that get to know the company. Get to know really well the company you are working with. What are their goals? What they are trying to reach? And become, and really, I mean, put it on the shirt and become a team player. Even this beyond your position, you may be able to speak about things and bring your point of view just because people see you're so invested in the product, in the company. So that's what we all should be doing. And anyone who's listening to this for the first time, and whether you are in localization and you're interested in the UX perspective or vice versa, or in business and interested in this, get to know the other part. There are tons of articles, lots of presentations and things out there. So just get to know more. That's how you're gonna be able to advocate, is because you have more knowledge about the overall picture.
Great, okay. Let's look at questions from the audience. I think we have a couple in the chat window and then a few more in the Q&A section. So I'll start here on the topic of working with the product UX team and the localization team, so collaboration. To that end, in your organizations, how have you structured your cadence of communications / meetings / interactions to bring those teams together? And have you managed to communicate to everyone involved why this is important?
So I think there's two different cases here. One is when you're working with a new product team. And for us, so perhaps someone who has come in with an acquisition, that's where we have really become organized so that we reach out to them as a group of teams that are not the core part of the product team. We are perhaps services that are available to them. We are the people who can help them understand what to do. And so we have a specific cadence of introducing the larger set of services, and perhaps localization and product documentation would be a part of that. I think in terms of existing products, that's where it's really hard when you're reaching out to people who haven't been as open to you in the past, perhaps. You have to do the right thing for them. There's not a set cadence. You have to find out what part of the organization. Is it product management? Is it engineering? Who holds the decision-making for that team? And approach that team appropriately. That's how I would start with the communication.
The other thing that I would add to what Mimo was saying, you know, there's this acronym WIFM. That's the radio station that everybody tunes into. What's in it for me? Put yourself in the shoes of the other of your stakeholders. Identify what is critical, what is valuable to them, and see how you can help them. Because by helping them, you're making yourself useful, and they are going to be more prone to bringing you into the fold. And in doing that, I would totally advise, you know, becoming a good storyteller. Identify three or four anecdotes that you can share with people to tell them about, you know, the pitfalls or the opportunities in what they are doing. A few years ago, I was doing something different, and you know, we were exercising an e-commerce site end to end, and we actually went through the process of returning a product into the company in one of the markets. And you know, we have bought some big boxes, you know, like gaming devices, which are fairly hefty, and we tried to return them. And one of the things that we found out was that in one of the markets, Singapore, if memory helps me, the person who came, the courier, was actually a bicycle driver. And there was no way under heaven that a bicycle driver would be able to pick up a gaming device box and bring it to a storage facility. So that sparked a very good conversation about, hey, how do you account for delivery services where everybody doesn't bring a truck by default? And that is a very good anecdote that I have used in communicating with new stakeholders who may be wondering, what is the value of what these people do? You paint a picture, you make it very tangible, and they say, okay, this person has got a good case, or else they have some research, and I can relate to how that is going to help me not do duplicate work or redo work in the future.
Okay. I can just add a simple perspective from our world at PayPal. So I was thinking of the role of the design, the content designer, so the content writer. And I see them as being almost like the center of this. You know, as they create, they're working hand in hand with the UX design team in our model, in our approach to how we create experiences. They influence the UX designer completely. At the same time, they're also interacting with the linguist and with the localization team and sharing, you know, the progress of how content is being created and what it looks like in the UI. So I think, I was just thinking that that role can you know, be critical to the success of the localization team as well. Like work with, you know, the source content creator, bring, you know, lean on them and ask them, you know, when does this, you know, when do we work together? How do we work together? We do have a cadence of communications and meetings that are kind of part of our process, where we bring in the localization program managers and the localization experts to work with that content designer. Now, is the UX designer in that conversation? Probably not, right? If something is flagged from a UX, UI design perspective by our content designer, yes, you know, they would be willing to come in and listen and you know, adjust the size of the button and whatever it may be, or the icons they're using. But I see that role playing a huge part in our approach, you know, to create that cadence of communications and visibility to the localization team.
We have a few more questions from the audience. So one is, how do you successfully sell UX localization to companies who balk at the high cost associated to not only with the initial project, but also the constant upkeep? So how do you convince people to do UX localization?
Okay, I can take that one. As a contractor currently, I am the lowest in the food chain possibly. But what I did is that I, once I started doing the work that I was hired to do, I started taking notes of the patterns. And so as I was progressing with the work I was hired to do, basically, I was creating on a side a case study that of all the things that I was seeing and all the patterns that were creating and issues that were either there or coming, right? So within a few weeks in the company, I asked to report what I had found. And then I created a presentation and I worked really hard on all the things I had found. I wrote all that I understood of the process. And then I suggested some things that could change. And I offered this presentation to my immediate supervisors. And this kind of escalated. It went up all the way up, I would say, 4 or 5 levels above my head. And people came back to me and said, tell me more. Because they were not seeing what I saw and they were not making those connections because I was looking at things from multiple perspectives. So independent where you are in a company, whether you are in a higher level or in a very bottom, you always have, if you have something to say that will contribute to the company, you can put on a side and create your own case study of the company. I mean, this is something that was happening at the same time I was doing my job. So I didn't have to take time off to do this. And as you do this, you start advocating for new ideas and new processes and new ways to fix gaps and issues that they had not seen it. And when they were catching on, it was like way later in the process because there was nobody hired to do this. They still don't, but I've been doing this I've been advocating and I've been telling them things that they know, don't know. So find what they don't know and then tell them and find out who you should tell them first and then try to get to the right people. Try to find the right stakeholders and then things will happen, right? So that's how everything works.
If I may add a few more comments, at the end of the day, you know, it's all a matter of ROI. And for that, you have to begin with the end in mind. You know, what is the ultimate goal of the product or service that you're working on? And that's typically, in some cases, profit, in other cases, distribution of information, depending on your product. So be very clear about the ultimate goal of your enterprise, and then present a viable case of how these activities can help you achieve that goal. If your goal is to get more dollars, then you know it's a matter of the opportunity cost. Do you want to invest in marketing in, say, the United States? Or do you think that by providing localization in Canada or, say, the Philippines, you're going to be able to grow your market? And you know, you can look at the relative ROIs. And in doing that, again, use whatever resources and research is available to you. We were talking about this paper that you guys have put together. There's also a very interesting study by PricewaterhouseCoopers, which is the world by 2050, which projects where GDP is going to grow between now and 2050, which is only 30 years away. And you know, they are saying that the largest GDP countries by GDP in the world are gonna be China, the United States, India, and then Indonesia. So if you use that macro trend, you know, that can help you inform and nudge your organization along to think about, hey, you know, if that's where the users and the dollars are going to grow, the dollars or the rupees, as the case may be, what are we doing to position our product for growth in the future? And that becomes a very exciting conversation, because again, if you're approaching this as I'm a cost, I'm a toll gate that you have to go through, people will tend to shy away and from you and avoid you. If you're thinking about, you know, this is our goal and this is how I can help you meet and exceed that goal, people are going to be more excited to partner with you.
Great. Moving on a bit here, we have a couple of questions still, some more coming in. So one big topic, future-looking topic, AI. So what role does AI play in terms of hyper-personalization with the customer experience? If any of you have looked at that.
AI is outside of my scope as of now. I have looked into some things just as curiosity. And one thing that I see that I thought was very interesting was I read a study that said if you try to have your chatterbox speak to the customer in the same tone as your company persona, let's use the example of Flo in Progressive. You know, she's kind of quirky, she's kind of funny. It's a big risk because yes, you may be kind of communicating that brand persona, but it may not be what the person on the other end talking to the chatterbox is expecting. So while there is a level of personalization that needs to be done, you need to think about when do you stop that personalization, either as the representation of the company or how the user expect to be talked to when they know they are talking to a robot. You know, this is a robot, you're not my best friend, so don't try to talk to me as I am your best friend. So there's a fine line on those. And there are many, many good studies out there if you're more interested in, but I haven't worked with that. I have, I'm interested, so I read a lot about it.
I think this is an area that depends so much on the industry that people are in. And so I've talked to some people in the game industry who have done really interesting things around this because they can track exactly what their users are doing. And the experiences that they present to them can be so customized to the user. I think the chat box is probably the in my enterprise software world, it's the closest thing that we get to having something that's informed by AI. But we're not at the point where we can collect enough data yet to really know each of our users. And so much is also held back. I won't say held back, but it's defined by privacy rules. And so that's one area where I think things are gonna have to shift a bit for us to really make changes in that direction.
One of the things that makes me think about in AI is also voice command, because it's kind of like in the same kind of ball game. And we see more and more because of all our devices. In my house, we are surrounded by Google and Alexa and all these different things because my husband loves those things. I keep waiting for him to bring one that will do the dishes. I haven't found that one yet. But voice interaction and AI are very correlated. So how we talk to these instruments. So you need to think that when you're talking about communication with a device, it has to be a simpler communication. You cannot ask deep and complex questions because the bot's not going to be able to answer it as of now. It will be scary when they start telling you, having very humanized conversation. But voice is another thing to think about AI and how we are going to deal with it as far as localization, what kind of voices we'll have in each different culture as we talk to those devices.
I think the one point that comes to mind in terms of AI is that, you know, you obviously want to approach language localization from an overall customer's perspective, right? What is the average customer's, you know, preference and need around language localization on this topic? But I think there's an